Okay, well, good morning, everyone. I'm Ron Martin, as the slide tells you, and it's fallen to me to welcome you and also provide a very sort of brief 15-minute sort of introduction. A bit of scene setting, if you like, context. So if what I'm about to say, I'm sure, will be familiar to many of you anyway, but hopefully we'll actually begin to set us off on these two themes that make up the conference. Just a brief word about the journal. As you know, the journal is theme-driven, so it publishes three issues a year. Each one is devoted to a theme. That makes it a bit different from many other journals. It also makes it, I should say, very hard work as well, organising the themes and keeping everyone together who are contributing to a particular issue. But it seems to work quite well, and in fact, our latest impact factor is 5.6, which we learned yesterday puts us above the Journal of Economic Geography, also above Regional Studies, and I think also E&P, Environment and Planning. So we're doing quite well, you know, and it is hard work, but I think it's very rewarding in terms of having these small conferences, almost like an enlarged workshop, I guess, which are usually on one theme, sometimes two, as today, but these themes then become the subject of our issues of the journal. Perhaps we'll say a bit more about that as the conference proceeds. So this year's conference is actually on two themes listed here: the entrepreneurial state, mission-orientated innovation policy, and then rethinking regional path dependence and lock-in. I think we've got some very interesting papers. We're also particularly delighted because we've got two outstanding international scholars giving plenary papers. One today by Marianne Feldman, Professor Marianne Feldman, who's here with us from Arizona State University, and also from Professor Frank Giles from Manchester University, UK, who'll be speaking tomorrow. So the question is, why have we got these two themes? Might get this to work. I think the background to this really is very much the recognition, as we all well know, that economies today face a plurality of major or big challenges. And climate change is one of them, of course. Slow growth in many cases, environmental crisis, health insecurity, demographic aging would be another one. Social and spatial inequality, most definitely one, which of course is very much a topic that's dear to our particular journal. And of course, technological change, the challenges, the possibilities and opportunities, and also the threats from AI that are looming rapidly over the horizon, if not already here. And in that context, states and regions are struggling to find new policy solutions or responses to those challenges. And you can see the revival, for example, of industrial policy, of what some people now call a more progressive supply side series of interventions. And of course, there's the need to undergo a green transition towards a net zero economy and production system. And in this context, there's been a call for a more proactive and more purposive form of state intervention under the label of the entrepreneurial state. And attached to that, the idea of mission-orientated policy as ways of dealing with these challenges and crises. Now, the idea of the entrepreneurial state is certainly not new. In fact, one can find mention of this and the entrepreneurial city, for example, in previous literature. But it's undergone a sort of major sort of revival or surge in interest and attention. And I guess one has to mention the work of Marianne Mazzucato in this context, a name I'm sure many of you will be familiar with, who's based and is indeed director of the Institute of Innovation and Public Policy, sorry, Public Purpose at University College London. And she's written a couple of books which have been extremely well publicised in part by Professor Mazzucato herself. Now, she actually defines mission-orientated policy in this way, as a sort of a more purposive engagement between government, the state, and business, with the idea of addressing particularly sort of targeted and big issue problems. And on the left there is my attempt to actually summarise what I think is the structure of her argument, that you identify these big, what she called big challenges or grand challenges, and in a sense they're things that are agreed of more or less by society as a whole as requiring some sort of attention and engagement. That then leads to the idea of identifying a series of missions, big policy programs, if you will, that are intended to address, resolve, or attack, if you like, the problems, the challenges that have been defined. And then the argument is that if you, in a sense, below that, you then have to have a series of policies, and particularly innovation policies of various sorts. And she talks about cross-section innovation policies and strategies, which in a sense derive from the missions. These missions are time-bound, targeted, purposive policies. Then these innovation projects sit below that, and indeed many of those actually are locally based, bottom-up, and experimental. So this whole thing is supposed to be a sort of multi-scalar, to some extent, multi-scalar enterprise. Now, this has actually been very widely adopted quite rapidly by a number of organisations. The EU, the OECD, talks in terms of mission-orientated policy. The UN, of course, with its sustainable development programmes, their missions. And you can find individual states adopting this whole mission sort of language. Indeed, here in the UK, the election of the new Labour government has identified five key missions. One can debate whether they are or not, or whether they're going to be successful or not. But this whole language, this whole discourse is actually being adopted widespread across different organisations, and indeed down to the individual city and region, you can find the idea of mission-led, mission-orientated policy. So it's become very popular very rapidly. However, there are issues with it, I think, and as you probably know, the notion has not gone uncontested from a variety of quarters. A number of authors have raised issues with it. And I just want to sort of talk very quickly about some of those. At one level, for example, there's been a critique that Matsukato herself has based this whole idea of mission on the NASA moonshot mission back in the 1960s, which of course was a state-led, in conjunction with NASA, a huge project, funded project, to put a person on the moon. Now, that's been criticised as a rather unique example of and way of defining a mission. So there's that level of critique or questioning. This hasn't gone down too well with Matsukato, I should say. I will say no more about that. However, there are other forms of criticism. The idea of missions does perhaps raise the issue of normativity. A normative statement is made about where society wants to go to or how it wants to resolve something. So this whole issue is shot through with underlying normative assumptions and presumptions. There's also the problem of lock-in. If you then devise a mission, you know, for example, of a particular way of addressing, say, net zero, then does that become locked in? So you, in a sense, you deprive yourself of flexibility in how you might address that mission. That's another possibility. Who sets the missions? This is an interesting issue. It tends to be a top-down process. The government, or an international overseeing body, defines the missions, but how does that then relate to the multi-scalar nature of the policies that are required to actually carry out that mission? There's also a question, is it really a way of the state picking winners again? You know, so is it actually that different from old industrial policy? Is it a new neologism for an old style of policy? These are all questions that different people have been asking. And I guess one of the interesting things for us is how does it relate to the other sort of trend, which is rapidly spreading across different organisations and indeed countries, the idea of place-based policy. You know, how does the place-based nature of policy, giving more devolution and autonomy to individual places, how does that then relate to these top-down missions that governments, for example, might introduce and pursue? So there's a whole series of, I haven't listed all of them clearly, but there's a whole series of interesting questions, I think. And I'm hoping that the conference will explore some of those. So that's the first theme. The second one is regional path dependence redux. This notion has been around some time, of course. I just want to briefly rehearse one or two ideas here. It's actually, next year will be 40 years since Paul David, an economic historian, or an historical economist, I don't know which way you say that, he came up with this paper, famous paper, infamous paper in many respects, about the economics of QWERTY, the keyboard, the layout of the keyboard, and how in a sense that was in competition with another layout, the Dvorak layout, which is different, but the QWERTY one in a sense assumed market dominance, and then it became locked in. So we've now got computers and so on, the one I'm looking at here, but it's still got the QWERTY keyboard layout. So it's in a sense a more or less happenstance or serendipitous event can lock in a long-term sequence of a particular outcome. And what's interesting about this, I think it does relate to the idea of mission-oriented innovation policy, because David's work was all about technologies, the QWERTY keyboards, the technology. And he argued essentially that institutions and technologies are the carriers of history. And that once you get a chance event, it may be a purely random event, provided other things begin to work, like, for example, sunk costs, or it might be increasing returns effects, or it may be network effects, they can lock in a particular path of development. And this is essentially what path dependence is, as it's defined by David, picked up by Brian Arthur, who was at Santa Fe Institute in the United States. And he actually had some interesting papers where he looked at geography, the geography of industrial location. Once industries find a location, they tend, in a sense, to stay there. So you get a buildup of a particular geographical pattern of industrial specialization. So we applied it to something which is, in a sense, much nearer, I guess, to many of the things we were interested in. And the idea has spread into a number of disciplines, from archaeology to anthropology, historical, sociology, politics, etc. And of course, regional studies. And I don't like to do this too much, but the paper that I wrote with my colleague Peter Sunday, who's here today, back in 2006, it's in the Journal of Economic Geography. It's a very long paper, about 42, 45 pages, a bit of a, as they call, a bowel breaker. But it's actually a paper which attempts to, in a sense, explore the notion within a regional setting. And there have been many, many, many other papers since, of course. Initially, the idea was on lock-in. You know, patterns of regional development get locked in. Places become specialized in industries. Industries stay there a long time, so you get a pattern locking in that way. More recent literature began to explore, well, okay, that may be one outcome, but there are other possibilities. Regions may evolve their industrial structures over time in various ways, so perhaps we need to look at other aspects of path dependence, like path creation, path branching, and path mutation and so on. And what I'm trying to do here, this is purely a very sketchy diagram, really, is to look at the canonical form, which is the top, which is the Paul David form. In other words, something gets locked in and it stays there, and it only changes in his model if you've got a shock to the system. That could be a technological shock, it may be a crisis shock or whatever, and then that might activate the rundown of that path of development and the institution of a new one. However, it seems to me, and we've written about this a lot, Peter and I, in various ways, there are other possibilities. The second row, in a sense, is really one which is more Schumpeterian, the idea of constant mutation of industries and technologies. So you've got a more mutational, adaptational way of looking at path dependence. It's still path dependence, but it's not that strong canonical form that Paul David and others have pioneered over the last 40 years or so. And then the final one is even more revolutionary, I think, in terms of the idea that paths can actually give rise to new paths. So you get path creation, branching, and so on. And that, in a sense, is much more emergent and it's more transformational. So in other words, one key issue, and we may explore this in the conference, is how path dependence links into the ideas of regional economic evolution over time. Some regions do get stuck with particular industries, particularly if they specialize in things like coal and steel. These are huge sunk costs, literally, you know, they get locked into those sort of industries. But in other instances, some regions find it much easier to adapt and change over time. And that leads into all sorts of discussions about related variety, diversification, and so on. So there are a whole series of questions about path dependence, some of them listed here. To what extent is it place-dependent process itself? Why are some regions more able than others to actually break the path and move into new structures? And something I would suggest, which I quite like the idea of, is it the case that if some regions manage to capture and lock into a particular industrial technological trajectory, they lock other areas out? So this is an interesting way of possibly combining the idea of path dependence and lock-in with the, I suppose, the rather radical one was back in the 80s, the idea of combined and uneven regional development. So I'll end there. I've gone over slightly, but let me finish there. And without any more ado, hand over to Pete Tyler, who's going to introduce Mary Ann Feldman, our first plenary speaker. So thanks very much indeed.